Disasters that can befall humanity, especially the ones from space, I would rank asteroids as number one. If we do nothing, they are guaranteed to hit us.
This is Philip Platt, American astronomer.
This is a bigger concern to me than, for example, terrorism. The odds of a terrorist attack are actually quite low, whereas the odds of one hitting us are relatively high.
We've had 8 impacts in the last decade that have been at the size of an atomic weapon or larger.
Ed Liu, a former NASA astronaut.
What is our current worldwide strategy for dealing with this problem? Our current strategy is blind luck.
You might think that the chances of us being hit by an asteroid are so low that we needn't really worry about it. But firstly, that's probably what the dinosaurs thought. And secondly, over the last couple of decades, there's been increasing evidence that we're less safe than we thought we were, and we probably ought to take more interest in what's heading our way. In 1998, NASA started a so-called Space Guard survey, trying to find hazardous near-Earth objects. Space Guard is now an international program, and I went to see UK Space Guard. It's at the top of a hill in mid Wales at the former Powys County Observatory.
Nearly got stuck there. It says, please shut the gate, sheep. Okay, nearly there. The Space Guard Centre.
Hello. Welcome to the top of the hill.
Yes.
The man who runs Space Guard UK is Jay Tate, a retired pipe-smoking army major.
Unless you've started to prepare well ahead of the event, you're likely to be caught with your pants down. The earlier you start, the more prepared you're going to be come the day.
What's the chance of a really big one coming out of left field?
100%.
Mr. Tate runs tours twice a day, 5 days a week. Quite often no one turns up, but today there are 4 visitors.
Now, have any of you been up here before?
Mr. Tate's moment of revelation came in 1994.
When the fragments of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 hit Jupiter, the scars on the planet were really very visible. You could see them through a small amateur telescope. And it sort of seemed like a good idea to find out what was in place in case it was going to happen here. On sort of asking around and some investigation to find out what was in place, it became very clear that there was nothing.
You were doing what at the time?
I was in the army at the time. It seemed like an idea to come up with a plan.
Was this any part of your job description?
No. In fact, the Ministry of Defence really didn't like what I was doing at all.
So did you get in touch with them and say, what are your contingency plans?
Yep. In fact, I wrote a military paper on the subject, which launched up the chain of command and then ground to a sudden halt.
So hang on, you saw a comet smash into Jupiter?
I think the whole world did, yeah.
And you thought, this might happen to us?
Well, we know it's happened here many times.
It might happen again?
Well, it will happen again.
We ought to have some defence.
We ought to have something in place to...
And this should be an MOD responsibility?
Well, the initial thought was it's certainly a defence issue, and perhaps the MOD ought to be involved.
Did they think you were eccentric? I mean, what was...
Oh, certainly eccentric.
Mr. Tate's talk takes 90 minutes. He doesn't invite questions, but concentrates on delivering the terrifying facts.
That's what Mercury looks like. You can see that the whole thing's covered in holes. Now, if you go out to Venus, that one's covered in holes. Everywhere you look in the solar system, everything's been battered to death. And people used to think that for some reason the Earth had just got away with it. Until we started looking at the Earth from the outside. That's when we realised we got that wrong as well. Nowadays, wherever you look on the Earth, we're finding craters.
Back in 2000, Major Tate and others badgered the Department of Trade into setting up a task force looking into the threat from near-Earth objects. It recommended setting up a Near-Earth Objects Information Centre. Mr. Tate wanted to be that centre, but his bid was turned down.
It was eventually given to the preferred bidder. That's the big space centre in Leicester. They got a huge wad of money.
What did they do with it?
They set up a rather small display, rather smaller than we've got here, and a website.
A display, you mean like a kind of notice board?
Yeah. And so things remained until about this time last year when the government funding to maintain the website was stopped. So they closed the National Near Earth Object Information Centre. We suggested that we could take it on, and we did. And we officially opened as the National Near Earth Information Centre in October.
Does that bring any money?
No.
How's it funded?
The till in the shop.
So the sale of key rings?
Absolutely.
Rubbers?
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems inadequate as a national response to,
shall we say,
the end of civilisation.
We rather look at it in a similar way.
But who would Mr Tait tell if he saw an asteroid or a comet coming towards Earth?
There's nobody in the UK to tell. There's nobody in the Ministry of Defence who deals with this.
Right.
There's nobody in the civil service who deals with this.
The Americans will look after us, won't they?
That's the other reason they're not too fussed, because they think the Americans have got it all sewn up and we needn't worry. Well, they haven't.
But NASA is on the case. At about the time that Major Tait started to get concerned, Congress told NASA to start its Space Guard survey, looking for big, hazardous near-Earth objects. Lindley Johnson is NASA's program executive.
We've believe, based upon our population estimates, that we've found about 96% of the asteroids larger than 1 kilometer that come close to the Earth. For an Earth-approaching asteroid, something that's a kilometer in size or larger is pretty big, and of course, if it were to impact the Earth, that would be a pretty bad day for all of us.
How long will it take you to get the rest of them? I mean, are you trying to get the rest of them?
We're actually trying to find as many of them as we can. Our whole objective is to find them before they
find us.
Right.
What's the smallest you can reasonably expect to find?
Right now, our systems are sized to try to find 100-meter-sized objects 100 million miles away.
100 meters is still pretty dangerous if it lands on Earth, isn't it?
Sure, yes. A 100-meter-sized asteroid, if it were to hit in the middle of London, would pretty much devastate the entire southern part of the island.
How long will it take to get those ones that are between 100 meters and 1,000 meters?
If we just stick with the current ground-based telescopes that we have, it's going to take us several decades to find them all.
A 1 kilometer asteroid of the kind that NASA has now found most of would probably be globally catastrophic if it hit us. But forewarned is forearmed, and if you see an asteroid coming and you've got enough time, you can send up a rocket to give it a thump and shove it into a different trajectory. You can even station a spacecraft next to it and use the gravitational pull to move it a bit. But you do need to see them coming, and with the smaller ones, we just can't. The place that keeps a record of known near-Earth objects is the Minor Planet Center at Harvard, where the deputy director is expatriate Gareth Williams.
The sizes at which we need to be worried about start at about 20 metres. Objects in the range 20 to 50 metres don't generally survive passage through the atmosphere, but can airburst, like an atomic explosion.
How many of them have you got, then, ones greater than 20 metres? I mean, what proportion of them do you think?
We're not even at 1% of the total population that are known to us.
So you could look at it like this. There's a lot of potential atom bombs out there which could explode over us at any time, and we only know where less than 1% of them are.
That is correct, which means that if an asteroid airbursts over a major city today, the chances are that it will be something that we've never seen before, that we'll have no warning and there'll just be a big explosion over a city.
Like this one.
A powerful shockwave shattered windows.
Last February, an asteroid did explode over a city, Chelyabinsk in Russia. And because the Russians nowadays like to film things on their car dash cams, there's a huge amount of footage. Peter Yeniskens, a research scientist at the SETI Institute in California, went to Chelyabinsk to look for asteroid fragments and to talk to eyewitnesses. A note on terminology here. Once an asteroid enters the atmosphere, it becomes a meteor, and the bits that land on the ground are meteorites.
What made this thing unique is that there was this air burst, a big blast wave, a shock wave that penetrated all the way to the ground. people were blown off their feet by the sheer size of it. And that was the first time that real damage was caused on the ground that was well documented.
How many atom bombs worth are we talking about?
It's hard to believe, but the energy was about 40 times that of the bomb that detonated in Hiroshima. 40 times. We're talking 500 kilotons. If this energy would actually have been deposited at the Earth's surface, you know, you would have ended up in an impact crater. Instead, most of this energy was deposited in the atmosphere.
Why was it deposited in the atmosphere rather than on the ground? Because, of course, the damage in terms of broken windows was quite a lot, but nothing like 40 nuclear bombs.
No, the key here was the material properties of the rock that came in. The rock, when it reached about 30 kilometers, very rapidly started to fall apart into pieces. We examined the meteorites that were recovered on the ground and found that they were riddled with cracks. And it turned out that if you carefully examine those cracks, they contained a weakness that is not always seen in meteorites. And so we think that just the fact that this rock was riddled with these veins was one reason why the rock so effectively broke when it came down to 30 kilometers. In a certain sense, we were lucky by the properties this rock had.
Ed Liu, the former NASA astronaut.
The only reason we didn't have a million casualties in that case is because it happened outside the city, and that asteroid happened to be running almost parallel to the ground. In other words, it was a grazing impact with Earth. So we essentially got lucky. The next time an asteroid of that size is to hit the Earth, as things stand today, will almost certainly be unannounced. Just like the one last February 15th.
And it might be made of something different and come in at a different angle. American astronomer Phil Plait.
They're all different. For example, in Arizona, there is a crater roughly a mile across called Meteor Crater. And that was an iron asteroid roughly 30 meters across that slammed into the desert about 50,000 years ago. Well, 100 years ago, something made of loose rock slammed into Russia in the Siberian area and exploded several miles up, much like the Chelyabinsk impact, except much larger. The same size, two totally different impact events. So what do you tell people? You know, if you see something Chelyabinsk-sized coming in, 20, 30 meters across, is it going to simply come in at a shallow angle and blow up high up and you're relatively safe? Is it made of iron and going to hit the ground? Is it made of rock and coming in at a steeper angle and therefore can focus its energy in a more tightly constrained explosion? We don't know.
After Chelyabinsk, scientists started to ask how many more small asteroids there might be out there and how many of them might actually be exploding over us without us noticing. The answer turned out to be slightly scary. Alan Fitzsimmons is Professor of Astronomy at Queen's University Belfast.
There is an international array of ultrasound detectors looking for unannounced nuclear explosions. And when an asteroid explodes in the atmosphere, it sets out a pressure wave that these ultrasound detectors can see. And so the scientists found that there are roughly 10 times as many of these airbursts as we previously thought. Now, the fact that we're a factor of 10 out is slightly worrying, but possibly not surprising, because for the larger asteroids, we have some handle on how many there are out there, because we see them regularly with our telescopes as they go past the Earth, and so we can do a head count. But for the smaller objects, we see them very rarely. There's simply not enough found by telescopic means to give us a good estimate of how many there are. There could be a number of these small asteroids effectively sharing the Earth's orbit. That would allow them to hit the Earth more frequently, but we wouldn't necessarily be able to spot them very easily by our telescopes. Another possibility is that we estimate how many small asteroids there are out there by counting craters on the Moon. So it could be that as when we look at the Moon's surface, we're taking an average over many millions or billions of years. It could be that right now we are at a time when the number of smaller asteroids coming towards us is enhanced.
Or maybe there's something atypical about the ones that are coming towards us. Maybe there are some in a particular Earth-threatening orbit which are not typical of the population of near-Earth asteroids as a whole.
That is a possibility, and in fact we know that whatever hit us over Chelyabinsk was once part of a much larger asteroid. However, there are more than one possible parent bodies for this small asteroid, and it's not clear we'll ever be able to certainly identify whether or not there's another asteroid out there associated with it.
One result of Chelyabinsk was that the US Congress found a bit more money for NASA to look for smaller asteroids. The trouble with the little ones is that they're hard to see from the Earth, particularly if the sun's in the way. You need a space-based infrared telescope, but luckily NASA has got a spare one up there, which it started using for asteroid hunting. NASA's Lindley Johnson.
It wasn't originally designed to do that. It was originally launched for astrophysical purposes, but we quickly figured out that we could use that to detect asteroids. And with the additional funding that my program has gotten last year, we have reactivated that spacecraft. It just started into operations 2 months ago and has already found 6 near-Earth asteroids and a previously unknown comet.
Which is not enough, says Ed Liu.
It is finding approximately 50 asteroids per year. That's all it's capable of. Again, do the math. You're trying to find 1 million asteroids, and it is finding 50 per year. It's a research telescope. That's all it is.
So the nuclear explosions monitoring data suggests that there's quite a lot more asteroids hitting us than we thought. But luckily, most of them explode where they're never seen. Current thinking is that something as big as Chelyabinsk might happen every 20 or 30 years. But we've got very little chance of seeing them coming.
We've only detected 2 objects prior to their impact with the atmosphere.
Gareth Williams of the Minor Planet Centre.
One occurred in 2008, the object designated 2008 TC3, which landed in the desert in the Sudan. It was probably around 6 o'clock in the morning, and we were in bed, my wife and I, and our dog was fussing. Wouldn't stop fussing, so I got up to let her out. And while I was down there, I checked the computer to see what mail had come in overnight and noticed that this object was being flagged by our procedures. So I looked at it more closely and realized that this was going to come very, very close. So I alerted my boss, and within about an hour or so, I decided that this was something I needed to alert NASA with.
At that time, it was a little difficult to talk to a Sudanese government because it didn't really exist. But we did alert the international community. In fact, the entry was actually seen by an airline pilot, and he was able to see it based on those predictions.
So the dog fussing meant that we had a very good handle very quickly on tracking an object that was the first known object that actually hit us.
Yes. Is there anything better? Have you changed anything since then? Do you rely on dogs still, or have you got a...
Oh, no. We have an email alert system that is supposed to send out emails to pagers and what have you. Unfortunately, my pager company decided to can my service without warning, so I'm currently without a pager.
But actually finding new asteroids is only part of the problem. Once you've found one, you've got to work out where it's going, which means taking a series of observations to determine the trajectory. Jay Tate from Spaceguard UK.
These days, discovery is very much the field for the professionals. What isn't is the tracking and the follow-up. That's almost entirely done by amateurs.
How many have you tracked?
Well, we've sent just over 120,000 individual observations to the Minor Planet Centre.
So is it fair to say that the safety of the Earth is in the hands of amateurs with
yes.
telescopes
oh,
in their back garden?
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that.
Right, so the observatory's over there. Right, as we go in, you've really got to duck your head.
I'll put the lights on in there.
Peter Birtwistle lives in a village in Berkshire, and he's probably the world's most prolific amateur asteroid hunter.
So we're out in the telescope dome, in the middle of the garden.
So it's actually quite a cloudy night.
Well, there are a few gaps. We might be lucky and get a few clear periods. The main object that I'd like to try and image tonight is actually just over the house roof, and it's going to go very close to the Earth in 2 days' time. But first things first, let's move the telescope to the right place.
Peter found the asteroid, took a series of photographs of it moving against the fixed background of the stars, and back inside, emailed his findings off to the Minor Planet Centre.
So this is 2014 DX110.
That's its name?
That's its name.
Who gave it that name?
The Minor Planet Center. So when this was discovered by a professional observatory in Hawaii. They picked it up. That wasn't seen again until a night and a half later when I was out and tried to find it.
Was it lost?
Well, you've got that period between first being discovered and the next observatory seeing it. So if nobody picks it up soon, then the uncertainties of where it might be in the sky can get so much that it does get lost. Everybody in this game is trying to stop that happening. So this object a couple of nights ago was discovered. It went for a day and a half without being reported, and I went to look for it in the predicted place and couldn't find it. And it should have been bright enough for me to pick up. So I then went back and looked at the original discovery positions for it and tried to figure out, well, if it's not where the prediction is, then where else could it be? And so I went off hunting for it. I managed to find it, but in the meantime, it's been reported as potentially an object that could hit the Earth in the future.
Peter's asteroid even made it to the news channels.
Earth is going to have a close call with an asteroid today. How close? Well, an asteroid will actually be closer than the moon. Up to the Minute News, Matthew Smith explains NASA is breathing a sigh of relief. That's pretty close, Matt.
Yeah, pretty
close. But should NASA have been keeping a closer eye on it?
I sort of dispute you're saying that it was lost. It was observed, and the initial orbit was calculated, which predicts where it will be in the future. And then the other observers are able to then pick it up based on that.
But it wasn't there when he looked for where it was predicted to be. It wasn't there. He found it somewhere else.
Well, I don't know the specific circumstances that you're talking about, but to my knowledge, once we found DX-110, we haven't lost it.
Well, no one knew where it was until Peter Birtwistle found it.
Every clear night, there's always near-Earth asteroids to image, and I average something like 160 or 180 nights a year where I'm doing this sort of measurement.
What about sleeping?
Yeah, that is a problem. You do get used to not having too much sleep. I'll sit on the sofa, set my phone to wake me up in half an hour, and try and catnap like that.
Do you sleep during the day?
No. I've got a day job, and that's fine.
What do you do in the day? I hope it's not something which requires you to be awake.
Yeah, aircraft pilot, yeah. I'm working IT, but by the time I shut the telescope down at the end of the night, then if I get a couple of hours sleep, then that's fine. That'll set me up nice for the day.
You talk as if you've got to do it. It isn't actually compulsory.
Don't get paid. I don't have to do it, but yeah, it's strange. They all need observing, basically.
But you are married.
Yeah.
What does she think of it?
She's very interested to understand, you know, what may or may not be about to hit us and all this sort of stuff, but she's very happy to not get too much detail. And she had to give up part of the garden for the observatory as well.
She actually ever say, come on, come to bed?
Well, no, she understands now that unless it clouds over, it's not going to happen.
Well, it's good to know that Peter Birtwistle and Jay Tate are protecting us. The Minor Planet Center can't really direct amateurs like them.
We have no real control over what observers observe. We can make recommendations, but observers observe where they want to observe in the sky. So in that sense, it's like trying to herd cats. You have a general idea of where you want them to go, but they've got their own idea of how they get there.
The good news in all this? Well, there is some. Former astronaut Ed Liu heads up something called the B612 Foundation. First, his restatement of the problem.
There are about 1 million asteroids large enough to destroy a city that are orbiting the sun at this very moment. And all the world space agencies combined, which is mostly due to NASA, are finding approximately 1,000 per year. At this rate, it will take 1,000 years to complete that survey. What we are building is a telescope called Sentinel. It's going to orbit the sun about 30 million miles closer to the sun than the Earth is, i.e. it's an orbit very similar to the orbit of the planet Venus. And that'll allow it to look away from the sun and see Earth's orbit. And that's how you will spot these asteroids decades before they hit the Earth. Not days or weeks or months, but decades.
And how small an asteroid will you be able to see?
Tens of meters, you should be thinking.
How much will this telescope cost?
About as much as building a large freeway overpass, or if you'd like, perhaps, a medium-sized art museum.
How are you raising the money?
We are raising the money exactly like an art museum would, or any of the tens of thousands of philanthropic projects currently going on around the world today, you know, essentially by asking people to support the project. And that's what it'll take to save the world, which is rather interesting, isn't it? Because the governments of the world are absolutely not doing this. And I know this because, you know, I worked for NASA for 12 years. I know as much about this as anybody in the world.
And NASA, too, is relying on Ed Lu's telescope. Yes, says Mr. Lu, we can hope for the best. It might work, just like the residents in New Orleans were hoping for the best until Hurricane Katrina turned up. But if we want to be sure, it depends on you and me chipping in. A fiver here, a fiver there. And, of course, on Major Jay Tate, retired in Wales. Back at Spaceguard UK, he's looking forward to getting his hands on a new telescope that's been donated by Cambridge University. It's the biggest telescope in Wales, but it's currently in storage in the valley while he and volunteers construct a new building for it. But when he gets it, he has ambitions not just to track asteroids, but to find new and scary things out there.
The other population that I'm really sure we have underestimated are the extinct or dead comets. Comets that have essentially outgassed all the volatiles, and they'll look exactly the same as a very dark asteroid, but in an orbit like a comet. And because they're so dark, they are really hard to see. And the problem is that comets travel much, much faster than asteroids do. You only need a very small bit of comet to deliver the same energy as a pretty big asteroid. And if there's lots and lots of these things out there that we haven't seen yet, that could be a little bit of a problem.
How much warning would we get?
At best, probably about 4 seconds.